the more you know about wine, the more you realize you really don't know much.
One thing that is so exciting about Australian wine, and I suspect the wine industry internationally, is that everyone's got a story.
You know, you're trying to actually just make each one of these vineyards kind of sing its own song.
But I think people don't realize how much energy, that's part of the fun of what we do.
Wine writing has devolved to coming up with as many descriptors of the wine. Oh, this is cherries, this is apricots, this is prunes.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 364. This week we feature Dario Satui, Castello di Amorosa, Napa Valley. Only one man has built a 13th century castle in Napa Valley, and his name is Dario Satui. If you were unaware that there was a castle in Napa, all you'd have to do is travel up valley to Calistoga, and then go up the drive which reveals Castello di Amorosa. Dario started with V. Satui Winery and worked incredibly hard to eventually build the castle. This is no amusement park. This is a bona fide winery. Dario was a great interview, combining humor, storytelling, and passion, along with a dash of self-deprecation. His story is impressive, and his drive inspiring. Listen along to a Napa Valley legend to see how it all began. You can also hear Dario on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the phrase, "the crazy bastard that built the castle." We offer two videos with this podcast, so please check them out on our YouTube channel.
Back in Napa and at the castle, boy, you can't be at a better place. We are at Castello di Amorosa.
Had you pronounced it correctly for a change.
I'm here with Dario Satui, and Dario, I have to say, first things first, it is a real honor to meet you. What you've done and what you've accomplished in this valley is astronomical in my mind.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you for meeting with me. So I'm going to go backwards. I'm going to start from the present here for a moment and say, okay, you've got this incredible space that people want to see, and you also make fantastic wine. Where do you go from here?
I'm almost 78 years old. I don't know where I go from here. I want to enjoy my life. I have some property in Italy and also in France, and so I'm working less, I really enjoy the wine business. I've been in it more than 40 years, but I want to do some other things, travel, and I was so involved in the wine business, I didn't have much time for my friends and my relatives, and I want to spend more time doing other things than just the wine business. Probably not the answer you wanted to hear, but
no, it's what you like. I think the fact is you've earned this time to be able to enjoy, especially where you're at right now. So we obligatorily have to talk about the castle for a moment. This is modeled after a 13th century Tuscany?
It's originally, can I go way back?
Please.
Okay. I did not buy this property to build the castle. This property was for sale. I loved the house that I live in. It's a three-story Victorian with a wraparound porch. The property is 171 acres. It has a small lake up above here. It has a stream that runs part of the year. It has a lot of history. It's settled by Colonel William Nash, who came out from Tennessee a year before the gold was discovered. He was already famous because Nashville, Tennessee's named after his family. They were Revolutionary War heroes, his great-grandfather. So that was a beautiful property. I was going to semi-retire. My first winery, V. Satui Winery, was doing well. I was in my early 50s. I had planned on living in Europe several months a year, as well as here. However, the property came with this great permit. And the permit was for 250,000 gallons of wine production. The last public tour and tasting permit ever given in Napa County in 1988, I believe, and 130,000 square feet of new construction of building. The former owner took years to get the owner who sold me the property to get this permit. I gave it zero value. I didn't care. I didn't want another winery. I just wanted to live on the property. I was going to redevelop Nash's old vineyards and sell the grapes to my winery, Visa Tui Winery, and semi-retire. So then I started thinking over a period of months, and I love medieval architecture, and that's my downfall. It's a disease. Beautiful architecture to me is like a beautiful woman. I just get entranced. I get overcome, and I bought a small castle outside of Florence, which I subsequently sold. The following year, I bought a late 10th century monastery near Siena. I subsequently bought a Medici palace. Then I bought into a castle hotel, a medieval castle near Siena, near the monastery. And then I bought a castle in France 3 years ago, and I almost bought a second one. So you can see, I have a real problem. And I've almost bought several other places. So it's an incurable disease, but I love architecture. So what happened, I was going to build this little building in the medieval style after some months of reflection and make some small lots of Italian style wines. And the little building, which was going to be 8,500 square feet and patterned after my monastery, it was going to be like a monastery, ended up about 145,000 square feet. And after several years of construction, I decided, what does every boy want? Every boy wants a castle. So I changed the plans over the objections of the construction manager, and we fought over that, and we made a castle instead. So that's the story of the castle. And now I'm really happy. And I had no idea if it was going to work, no idea at all. I had nightmares over it. I knew people laughed at me, made fun of me behind my back, because I was so unorthodox, and they thought it would be Disneyland-like, Disney-esque, faux, fake. But I was determined I was going to get it right the best I could, and so I made great effort to do that. Oh, I'll give you one more thing. I took a sojourn in Italy, 1989, 6.5 months, lived in Rome, and I started going out in the countryside. And that's when I fell in love with medieval architecture. And there were a lot of vacant places then, a lot of farmhouses. People had moved to the towns, the cities, palaces, castles, churches. And so I would go in. I had a motorcycle and a car, and I'd usually or often go before dawn, come back after dark. Virtually nobody ever went with me twice. I was fanatical. I loved doing this. I had a backpack with a hammer, tape measure, sketch pad, and a metro. What do you call it? A tape measure. I'd measure these places. I took thousands of photographs, not knowing I was ever going to do anything, just for my own satisfaction and edification. And when I couldn't get into a place, that's why the hammer was for. I'd break in. I wouldn't steal anything. I'd always nail the door back or somehow force a window or
that was
something.
Very good of you.
And then when I couldn't do that, I would dress up and play like I had money and go to a real estate office, and I would say, I'm interested in buying a castle. What do you have to show me? So I was able to get into a lot of places, and a lot of places were for sale at that point. So then I had this catalog of thousands of photos, steps, chimneys, fireplaces, ceilings, walls, cellars, all these things. Just, again, for my own self, my own satisfaction, never thinking I was actually going to do it. And I met people who sold used materials, so forth. So when I decided to do the castle, or the first of the monastery which evolved in Newcastle. I already had done the research, years of research, because I took many trips to Italy. So I was more or less ready to go.
And here we are.
Yeah.
It's an amazing place. My favorite part about it is it's coming up the hill, because you don't know what you're going to see if you've never been here. And I've been here a number of times, but it's still a thrill. You come up and you see this, it's like, wow, where am I?
What happens, and it happened to me this morning when I came up to meet you, I drove up the hill behind a car. The car got to the crest of the hill. The castle's a little further up, but when he first saw the castle, the couple did. And they just stopped the car. And this happens all the time. And often traffic backs up people. They're in awe. And they just stop their cars and back up traffic. So I just went around the guy because I didn't want to be late.
You know, that's the thing, though. You don't know what's behind the trees. You don't know what's up the hill. And it reveals itself. And that's the true part of the beauty. But I'm also here to talk about wine. And that's the big thing we like to talk about. You're third generation, am I right on that?
Fourth generation.
My apologies. You're fourth generation. And maybe this is a crazy question, but do you ever come into the tasting room and just kind of hang out and watch people taste? I mean, is that something you like to do at all?
Okay. For years and years, I worked at taste room. I did everything. I cleaned the bathroom at Satui. You know, I had no money when I started. I slept in my van. I slept in the winery floor. I did everything. Took cold shower. I lived in one room for 11 years till my wife said, "You're a winery owner in Napa Valley. Why are we living in one room?" You know, and I did have a bathtub, but I had no kitchen, a hot plate. But I was always saving my money to reinvest in Visa Tui Winery. And so for, I don't know, 12 years or so, I worked tasting room as well as I managed the deli. I did pretty much, you know, as we grew, then we hired more employees. And initially here, I worked the tasting room as well for the first 5-6 years, but I'm starting to lose my hearing. I'm almost 78. I'm starting to lose my hearing a little bit, and also my legs aren't as good as they were. So it's hard for me to stand for long periods of time. So I don't normally work the tasting room anymore. I occasionally give a tour, but I'm more involved on the business side of it.
Sure.
At Satui, I made the wine because I had no money. I couldn't afford a winemaker, and the first few wines, I admit, weren't very good. And then they got better as I learned and corrected my mistakes. And then finally, I was able to afford a winemaker. Now the current winemaker, Brooks Painter, he's great, much, much better than I ever was. So,
he's been here for a long time, too.
Yeah,
he's a great guy.
About 11 years. And we liked him so much, we even gave him a small part of Visa Tui.
Oh, how nice.
And we pay them well, so nobody will steal them.
Well, I guess the crux of my question is for you, especially considering how you built this up, you're a self-made man, it had to be kind of a thrill. Did you ever work, when you did spend time in the tasting room, did you do it anonymously or did you let people know who you were?
I didn't say, I'm Dario Satui, the owner of the Castello d'Amoroso or Visa Tui Winery. But, you know, we've also done videos. I'm on some of the, all the tasting. So people would often know. I don't go around, you know, saying I'm the owner of the castle.
No.
But if people recognize me, I'm happy to take a photo with them, happy to talk with them. And I've always been really hands-on at Visa Tui and here, because it's one thing getting a report of what's going on, but that may be false, it may be exaggerated, it may be somebody else's interpretation of what's going on, and incorrect or somewhat incorrect. So I like to be really involved. So I come up here often and spend a couple hours and just watching people, watching pours, watching the service, just how they deal. You know, our customer service is real, real important to me. And so I'm trying to watch everything I can to make sure that it's working. And then I often take people aside to try to correct them. Or I tell the tasting room manager and get her to correct them. Huh. Yeah. Plus, I've met a lot of interesting people. Some of the customers have become good friends, or some acquaintances at least. And so it's, you know, I get a, what it gives me, look, I like making money, I won't deny it. First of all, I had no idea if this would ever work. But I think I'm honest to myself, I get more satisfaction than making money by giving enjoyment to people. Enjoyment in the architecture they see, enjoyment in the wines they taste and hopefully buy. And if they're pleased and excited when they leave, I know they're going to go home and tell their friends. And so if I can give a great experience and great wines and good value, I think I've done it all. And it makes me feel good knowing that I've brought some pleasure, some happiness to other people. And so I feel real good about that.
Well, when people see this, you know, it's amazing. So let's go back actually to your earlier days. I mean, you clearly worked with your hands to make this happen. Considering this whole lineage in your family of winemaking, was this it for you? This is the only thing you were going to do is make wine?
Okay, when I was a kid, first of all, my great-grandfather was one of California's first winemakers. Started in 1885, worked hard, did well, but then Prohibition forced him out of business. After Prohibition, my great-grandfather was 77 years old, so he didn't want to go back in the wine business. Yeah, he's my age, yeah. And then his sons went in the insurance business, did well in that. But typical Italian, all this is complex stories. In the old days, prior to the 06 earthquake, San Francisco had a lot of wineries. Oakland, Richmond, Marin had a lot of wineries. And it made sense. The roads were so bad, there was no bridge. You'd have to bring the grapes in a wagon or in a barge. Had you brought bottled wine down to the where the customers were in the urban areas, you would have broken some of the bottles before you ever got them down there. So basically, many, if not most of the wineries were in the metropolitan areas where the customers were. So they'd bring the grapes down there. So typical Italian, my relatives lived above the winery, and it's still there. It's not a winery anymore, 23rd and Bryant in the Mission District, and they still have full cellars underneath. And so as a kid, my parents would go over and visit the relatives. The first thing I ever noticed was the reek of wine when they'd open the door, you know, and I'd go up the steps to where they were. So I heard the stories, played in the cellar, saw the barrels, and I determined as a kid I was going to not revive, but try to encourage them to revive the family winery, which was called Visatui at that point too. I renamed it Visatui to give honor to my great-grandfather. And then at some point I could take it over. Well, that never happened. So after traveling in Europe and goofing off a little bit, I decided I didn't have a job. I came back to California. What am I going to do? Well, and the answer came really quickly. I'm going to do what I always wanted to do, which is revive Visatui Wine. Problem is, I didn't know anything about wine. I didn't have any. I had five. I've always been a little good, fairly good in business. I had a little money I made in Europe, and so I had $5,000. My mother gave me three more thousand, so I had $8,000. I thought I could start Visatui on $100,000, and I was convinced I could do that. I never raised $100,000. The most I ever raised was $62,500 from some other people. I didn't realize Davis, UC Davis, had done a study saying that to start a small winery, you needed $1 million. I didn't see that study, so I thought I could do it $100,000, which I never got. In any case, when I started out, I rented all my winery equipment. I didn't own the property. I didn't own the building. I couldn't afford a cash register. I had a little wooden box, made change, and wrote up every sale by hand. And my office had a hand crank calculator I spent $15 for. I had a reject door for $3 over two old barrels. That was my office. I slept in the winery. I slept in my van. I did everything to not go broke. The shelves we had were planks over old barrels. And What else? I made all every call collect. We didn't have a forklift. I know a lot of people laughed at me, you know. But what are you going to do? You know, if you don't have any money, you're starting out. You do the best you can. And
how old were you then?
I was 33 when I started the winery. Yeah, and I built it. Somebody else financed it. Fortunately, I got an option to buy it back, but he got an option to take stock, which he converted and made some money on that. We made a tiny profit the first year, $2,640. Otherwise, I would have had to go back scrubbing tanks for Christian Brothers, but I worked my tail off in doing it. I'd come home so tired, I worked 7 days a week, I'd just fall asleep. We didn't have hardly any furniture, I had a bed, but often I'd just fall asleep on the floor in a beanbag. Anyway, so it was really tough in the beginning, but I was determined I was going to make it work, and I my wife kept telling me it was going to fail, and you know, you hear it enough time from enough people, and you start wondering about our first day. We did $141 at Visa Tui, gross, and we only did in a 9-hour day. We only did that because a couple neighbors came and bought a bottle. A banker came who wouldn't lend me money, by the way, bought a bottle, and then none of them ever came back. The second day we did, I think it was $76 in a 9-hour day, gross. It was myself and my wife, and she kept saying, I told you you're going to go broke. And so I was scared to death, but I was determined not to fail. And we even had a deli case. It was rusting over at a market recently, Dean and DeLuca, and I covered the rust with some redwood, and I got an electrician to make it work. So I did everything. I didn't know how you were supposed to do it in the wine business, because I didn't know anything about the wine business. So I did it my way, which was picnic grounds, delicatessen, giving people a lot of reasons to stop at Visa Tui that other people weren't doing. Selling direct. We invented selling direct. Everybody laughed at me then, and now a lot of people are trying to copy me.
Yeah, it paid off, that's for sure.
Yeah.
After talking about all this, and obviously your success is proven in this very structure, you've done a lot of interviews in your career, so I got a very special question for you. What question haven't you been asked that you would like to be asked?
Oh, boy. that's a tough one. I'd probably have to reflect on that. Maybe it would be, what drove me to just do everything I could legally do, as far as work, as far as sacrifice. You know, I had a friend of mine produce the NFL CBS pro football games. Every time he came to San Francisco, he invited me to the 49er games. I never went. I had to work. You know, I always worked. And I sacrificed. Yeah, it's not totally true. I went out with some girls too. But basically, I sacrificed my 30s. I didn't go to a lot of parties. I just work. And 7 days a week. I did it the hard way. The way a lot of people do it in more recent years is they make their money somewhere else, or 50, 60, or older, and then it's a Napa Valley lifestyle. You know, if they don't make any money, they probably don't care that much. For me, it was sink or swim. You know, I didn't have any choice.
Yeah, that's the thing. You're an example for people who have dreams. That's the big thing.
I think if you really want something badly enough, and there's you can't do something that has no probability of working. But if you want something and it has some probability of working, and you're willing to make the effort and overcome the obstacles and never give up, there's a good chance you can get it. And this is true. When I was trying to raise money, it was 1973, and I was trying to stay alive. I was substitute teaching, working for BV as a tour guide at $4 an hour. And people I approached wouldn't invest with me. But I think they kept watching me, and they saw I think. They saw that I wouldn't give up, and I kept going after it and kept going after it. And then in the end, a couple that wouldn't invest in me did invest in me, and that was part of the $62,500 and some guy buying the property and putting up the building. And he'd been looking at me for 2 years and never told me he would invest with me. But I think because I think if you want something badly enough, you just never give up. And there's a good chance you'll get it.
That's great. I'm going to use that part. So what makes you crazy about the wine business?
I think it harkens back to being proud of my family that came over here, really poor immigrants, and they were willing to work hard and to make something of themselves. And had it not been for Prohibition, I probably would have inherited wealth. But maybe that would have destroyed me too. My dad was a cab driver, and we didn't have any money. And so I did it the hard way. And first of all, I love wine. I love the type of people that like wine. It's generally a more worldly, a more edified, a more educated type of person. And so I feel right at home with them. Hopefully they feel at home with me. You know, of all the businesses I could think of, I live in a great area. I'm a farmer in a sense. We have about 300 acres of grapes. I'm doing more or less everything I wanted to do. I don't have to commute to work. I just came up to visit some relatives from Carmel. It took me 4.5 hours. It was horrible. Just think of the people that have to commute every day. So I basically made a general plan for my life, what I wanted to do and how I wanted to do it, and I stuck with it. And wine business is great. And I know a lot of people don't make any money in it. Fortunately, I've done pretty well. So I'm really happy to be involved in the wine business.
Good answer. Let's get to the wine itself. Obviously, we're in, you know, Napa, we're in cab country, so obviously, and you do make cab and you make Chardonnay. What else do you make here?
Okay, the focus from the start, and we've continued with it, is make generally Italian-style wines, although we do make Cabernet, Merlot, Chardonnay, and wines that pair well with food. Wines that aren't too alcoholic, aren't over-oaked, wines that are well-balanced, that are elegant, that are rich and flavorful without being rough, tannic, harsh. And wines, I think the food makes the wine taste better, and the wine in turn enhances the food. And so that's what we've always attempted to do. And I also, with the reds, we try to make wines. You know, a lot of wineries, they're selling the reds at 2 years old. They're too young. And so I'm willing to spend money at a warehouse. Our Cabernet is 5 years old. Our reserve's 4.5 years old. It should be 5. It's just that we're selling so much of it. And so we're trying to give at least a year bottle age to the reds, and usually 2 and sometimes 3 years bottle age before they ever go out the door. So it softens the wine, it rounds out the wine. And so we're selling a product that you can consume that evening, although often with some of our better wines, I recommend that you bottle age it longer as well.
Now, there's been issues with labor all over the country in terms of being able to find people to do the job, and it's affected wine country as well. Does it have any effect on you trying to get the people in here, the people you need, both in the vineyard and in the cellar, or is that something, do you have a regular crew?
Okay.
How does that work with you?
Recently, we've had problems getting migratory people from Mexico. And there is, I think it's called the H-1-2 or something, visa program, where we can legally bring in people from Mexico to do the farm work, as long as they go back every year and we provide the housing for them. So we're going to bring in, I think, close to a dozen people to help us. And then we have our permanent staff. You know, the white people don't like to do the hard physical work anymore, as you know. So we have our permanent vineyard staff. And over the years, I've seen that our cellar crew, we have some gringos, but now it's mostly Mexicans doing that work as well. The winemakers are all gringos. But our vineyard manager, David Behar, Mexican guy, great guy, been with us about 25 years, good guy. And then we also bring in on the retail side, because we sell our wines at the winery, people from Europe. And often we get really good people. And we have right now 10 Italians, a few of whom were immigrated here and are here legally, and the rest are on a work experience visa program.
Like an internship.
Yeah, yeah, an internship.
Cool. Well, it sounds like then you at least you have things in control. Yeah. So do you have...
We are an Italian winery, by
the way.
Yeah,
you are. Yeah, well, it's nice to have Italian interns, actually. Does it give you a big concern for the future?
Yeah, because white people won't do physical work anymore. So, it is a concern. Hopefully, the two political parties will finally get together and come up with an immigration program that basically will satisfy more or less everybody, including those who have farms and those that run high-tech businesses.
I'm just about done, unless there's anything you want to cover. I've covered pretty much everything.
No, I really thank you, Ray, for coming all the way here and spending some time with us. I'm very grateful to you for doing that.
Thank you, Dario. You're fabulous to talk to because you're part of Napa Valley history.
Oh, thank you. I just think I'm an average guy that was willing to work hard and make a lot of sacrifices, and now I have it pretty easy. You know, people that work for me now, they don't see what it was like then. But I think average people can do so much if they believe in themselves, if they work hard, willing to pay the price. And I'm a cab driver's son. I know who I am. I'm nobody special. And so, but you can do a lot if you really want to.
Very good. Thank you, Dario.
Thank you.
Learn more by visiting CastelloDiAmorosa.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shear. Copyright 2019.